Okay, there we are. Can you hear me in the back? Talia, can you hear me?
You can.
Okay. Super. Thank you. Hi. Happy Wednesday. Happy end of January. Yeah. And it's been so cold recently that it's balanced the heat of the first half of the month, and the average temperature for the month, I heard today, will be just about normal. So we've been too hot and we've been too cold, and that makes it average. Be careful about statistics. It will not have been a normal month. Okay, so tomorrow is February. What do you do when you wake up in the morning? First day of a new month? Okay, if you don't know what that was about, ask somebody who will tell you that. What happens if the first thing you say in the morning on the first of the month is rabbit, rabbit? What happens?
Good luck for the
whole
month.
Good luck for the whole month. So. Right. And what usually happens is you get up and after you've talked to somebody, you realize you just blew the month. So.
Then you get to be mad at that person for the whole month.
Right. Don't talk to me in the morning. Okay. Does anybody know the origin of that? I have not a clue. I heard it sometime back in childhood and then forgot it for the next 40 years. And when I got married, my wife is a proponent, and she hits about 1 out of 3 months. She gets up before I do, and she gets it. But by the time I'm awake, she's already talking to me, so. Doesn't matter. So, if you want to research the history of that, I would love to know where it comes from. Because I don't have a clue. I will ask my wife. So, dear, if you're listening to this, let me know. It's only a fantasy that I have that she would bother listening to. Anyway. Okay. Questions? Housekeeping? Talia, announcements? Nothing? Talia was sitting in the office smiling today, reading your exercises. So, I don't know what that means. I don't know whether you should worry or not. No, I don't think you should. I think she was enjoying them. Right? Yeah. Okay. We were talking about love. I was talking about love. You were thinking about love. And we were talking about the characteristics of relationships. We've talked about activities. We started talking about relationships. We're going to wrap that up in the next few minutes and go on to talking about roles. And when we finish that today, we will have covered the three major components of the smallest system that we need to be thinking about, is the roles and relationships and activities are what goes on in our lives. Those are the three major components that a developmentologist looks at. But I want to make sure that we are reasonably clear that relationships also have three major characteristics, affect and power and reciprocity, and see if there were any questions that lingered in your mind as you thought about that since Monday afternoon. You talked about it at dinner last night with your friends, right? Maybe. But those are the three characteristics, and we described the dimensions, how they vary, and theoretically you can take any of your dyadic relationships and rate them on all three. So you think about your relationship with a parent, relationship with a sibling, relationship with your roommate. How would you describe the affect? How would you describe the reciprocity between you? How would you describe the reciprocity? Lost my train of thought there. And if you have very different kinds of relationships with different kind of people, it should show up in the way you rate those three. You could also think about changes in a particular relationship as involving increasing affect, increasingly positive affect or more negative affect, less or more reciprocity, less balanced power or more. So you can think about the history of a relationship in your life. And that, in fact, is the essence of the exercise 2, which we'll be doing a week from today. And we'll talk more about that on Monday, specifically what we're looking for. So review that and think about which dyadic relationships you're in that you might want to analyze for that exercise. And again, be assured that it's okay to talk about your friends and relatives in those exercises, because Talia and I are the only ones who will read them, and we promise not to remember anything that you say about your roommate, best friend, or parent. Okay. Now, think about the characteristics of relationships and how they relate to development. And Bronfenbrenner suggests that in Hypothesis 4, he suggests that the nature of those three characteristics is part of what makes a dyadic relationship good for you or bad for you. So the developmental potential of a dyad increases as a direct function of the level of reciprocity. That is, more reciprocity, more developmental potential. Okay, so think high reciprocity is good. Mutuality of positive feeling. So if in a dyad both people really enjoy their activities together and think highly of the relationship and of each other, that's likely to be a relationship that's also good for your development. And if there is a gradual shift of balance of power in favor of the developing person. So Bronfenbrenner's assuming that in many of our dyads, particularly if we're thinking about children, the relationship is between people who have different levels of power. There's an imbalance, parent and child, teacher and student, big brother, little brother. Those sorts of imbalances are common in our experience. And the potential of that relationship to promote the development of the younger or less well-developed person is a direct function of how much of the power is shifting toward the person who has less of it. So in a dyad, when you're moving toward balanced power, equal power, you're probably engaged in activities in which the less developed person is becoming more competent. And if the less developed person is getting more power in the relationship, there's probably some mentoring and tutoring going on, some encouragement for the younger person to take initiative and to influence the activities of the dyad. And that increases the balance of power. It makes the power more equal between the two. And Bronfenbrenner proposes that we learn more in dyads where we are experiencing a balance of power. So they're better for our development. And particularly that shift of power that goes along typically with reciprocity, an increase in the reciprocity, those are likely to be dyadic relationships in which the activities are encouraging us to become more complex and to develop a better, more valid view of the world that we live in. Relationships that are characterized by those three directions are also likely to last longer. So if you're becoming more reciprocal in a dyad, you're likely to be enjoying the give and take in it, and you're likely to have better skills at working out any conflicts that there might be in it. So the affect is going to continue to be positive, and the relationship will last longer with fewer problems as a result. Now, why do you want that kind of relationship? because you're engaging in things together, the joint activities in the dyad. And, observational learning is going to be more likely to happen when two people see themselves as in a dyad doing something together. So it's a joint activity dyad. And the developmental impact of the learning and the activity is going to be enhanced in the context of a primary dyad. If it's one that continues over time and you think about each other when you're not together, and there's mutual positive feeling, you're likely to be engaged in activities that are going to increase your learning. Hypothesis 6. And if there's antagonism in a dyad, in the dyadic relationship, if it's characterized by negative affect, then that disrupts the learning possibility in that dyad. So as you're looking at your relationships, the ones that have conflict in them and mutually antagonistic feelings are not likely to be terribly good for you. They're the ones you avoid. So you don't have a lot of chance to learn things other than conflict resolution skills, which might be good for you, or how to avoid the relationship, or how to break up. Okay. And in 7, Bronfenbrenner suggests that, again, these all overlap. They're all related to each other, but he wants to approach it from each direction, that it helps. The dyad is helpful to your development if there are progressively more complex activities and there's a pattern of reciprocity in those activities and strong and enduring emotional attachment. In other words, it's a primary dyad and it's carried on and the balance of power is shifting toward you, toward the less developed person. So he's wrapping all of these things together. We talked about the activities, and activities that become more complex are better for you, and if they occur in the context of a primary dyad, that's even better. And then if you want to put roses on the whole thing or icing on the cake, you want the increasing reciprocity, increasing complexity of the activities, and mutually positive feeling, and a balance of power moving toward that anyway. So think about the relationships that you really have learned in, that you really enjoy. Think about the teachers who were really great. Think about the parent that you really admire. Doesn't have to be your own, somebody else's parent. Think about the dyadic relationships that that person is able to promote and engage in with people who are less well-developed. If you're going to be an educator, think about how you, as a teacher, will be creating this kind of dyadic relationship that will promote the learning and development of your students. How does a teacher create that kind of dyadic relationship and maintain it in a classroom when you've got 20 people to have those dyadic relationships with? It's not an easy task. And then Bronfenbrenner also suggests that whenever you're looking at a setting, he applies this one to research settings. He's giving advice to researchers. If you're not looking at the impact of the other people in the setting, you're missing something about what's going on. And he says that whenever we're in a dyadic relationship, any other dyads that exist in the same setting are going to have an impact on us. There's going to be an indirect influence, and he calls that a second-order effect. The first-order effect is the direct effect that happens within the dyad, but there are also indirect effects. What he means by that is that if A and B are in a dyadic relationship, they're affecting each other. That's the first-order effect. But if C is also in another dyadic relationship, that relationship is going to have an impact also on the original dyadic relationship, and that's going to be an indirect effect because C, presumably in this case, is not directly interacting with A, but is interacting with B, but they're creating a system of relationships, and those indirect effects he calls a second order effect. A would also have an impact on the dyad between B and C, so that second order effect is reciprocal, it's mutual. Thank you. That's an important clarification. Can you think about what a third order effect might be? Bronfenbrenner doesn't talk about it, but the logic of his analysis suggests that if C is in a dyadic relationship with D, that also might have an impact on the original dyad, and that one would be a third order effect. Talia, would you remind me to do an overhead on that? Because I haven't yet. And the dyad between C and D would have a second order effect on the dyad between B and C. Okay. So it's just talking about how far away, how indirect the relationships are. But importantly, what he is saying is that the existence of any of those dyads is likely to impact the other dyads. So he's beginning to set us up to think about a system of relationships within a setting. And he's going to tell the researchers, and I'm going to tell you, that when you look at what's going on in a setting that has several different people in it, you have to assume that and you have to look for the second and third order effects. How are these dyads influencing each other? The example that I suggested in the book that you think about is to look at the parent-child triad. So you've got father and mother, and then you add a child. So it's a triad, and there are three dyads. And his point, and it's a very important point in looking at the family in any of its configurations, is that each dyad is going to influence the nature of the other dyads. So if dad is trying to create a relationship with the baby, the relationship that dad has with mom will have an impact on dad's ability to do that. If mom's relationship with dad is such that she's gatekeeping and shutting him out, she may interfere with his relationship with the baby. She may be jealous of it. Her relationship with the baby will influence dad's relationship with the baby. She may not give him any time. And dad may be annoyed with mom because she's spending time with baby. And he's going to affect the mom-baby relationship if he's angry with mom. So she's reluctant to spend as much time with the baby because it makes him angry in this relationship. And that impacts her ability to be a mom. So immediately, when you start applying that notion of first and second order and perhaps third order effects within a family setting, you can see that it may be useful in understanding why it's important to have each of those dyads be as developmentally facilitating as possible. And we see this particularly when you add a new baby to a couple relationship. It's quite a change. If a couple have been together, and we'll talk about this in the second unit in more detail, we'll look at some of the research on what I call how to ruin a perfectly good relationship, which is put a baby in it. Mom and dad, even if they want the baby, have a great deal of changing to do because the existence of these two relationships is going to have a major impact on their couple relationship. And it's really helpful if you understand that baby is trying to destroy your relationship. I say that a little provocatively, but if you understand, and I occasionally get told, you can't blame babies. Well, no, and you shouldn't punish them for destroying your relationship, but if you understand the second order effect that's happening in your marital relationship, you have a better chance to figure out what you need to do to maintain it. And I've been watching a couple of examples this year that are striking to me. Both couples having difficulty in their relationship with a new baby coming into the household. And one of those is a relationship where they tried for about 7 or 8 years to have a baby, and they finally succeeded, and they have this beautiful, healthy, wonderful baby who's actually now over a year old. And mom is so protective and hung up on this baby's development that she is ignoring her relationship with her husband. He's been trying fairly desperately to maintain it, but she is so hung up on keeping the baby safe that she won't leave the baby with a babysitter. So they can't go out for dinner. They've been invited for weekends with friends. He wanted to do something for their anniversary, and her relationship with the baby is keeping her from being involved and supportive in the marital relationship, and they're in deep trouble. And I won't, the other one is a little bit different, but you get the point that putting a baby in creates a lot of stresses, creates a lot of fun and interest, and when you do that, you potentially jeopardize the positive affect in the original marital relationship. So you have to be very aware, and as a result of this course you will be aware, that if you want your marriage to survive, you have to make sure that you maintain that dyad. I'll save the other story for when we get there in its appropriate context. Okay. And this is sort of summarizing that notion and making it more general, that if you want the dyad to function effectively, okay, any of those three dyads, if you want them to function effectively, then that will depend on the existence and nature of other dyadic relationships with third parties. So the nature of the other dyads in the setting will determine whether or not the dyad that you're looking at can serve as a setting, as a developmentally potentially facilitating dyad. The developmental potential of the original dyad is enhanced to the extent that each of these external dyads involves mutually positive feelings and the third parties are supportive of the developmental activities carried out in the original dyad. So if we want to focus on the dad and the baby dyad, mom can be supportive of that dyad and the activities in it, or she can interfere with them. You might ask, why would a woman do that? But they do that. It's called gatekeeping. They interfere with the father-child dyad. Similarly, dad can interfere with the mother-baby dyad, and the baby may not be at all supportive of the parental dyad. Okay. Conversely, the developmental potential of the dyad is impaired to the extent that there's mutual antagonism or the third party discourages. Okay? Apply that to marriages you might be familiar with. Or to your own significant relationships. Some of you have had the experience of having parents who hated your partner or didn't like him. Remember? You don't have to raise your hand. But many of you have partnered up with people that your parents didn't think well of, and they may have actively discouraged the relationship. And it's difficult to maintain a relationship if other significant people in your life don't approve of it and they discourage it. They invite you for dinner, but not your partner. You show up for holidays and you get a present, but they sort of completely ignore your partner and tell you, well, you know, would have been nicer if you hadn't brought her. So, if you're looking at wanting to support a relationship, if you want to be in a supportive environment, you obviously choose partners that your parents approve of. Or, if you're the parent, you make sure that you are supportive of your kids' partnerships. And one reason for doing that is many of us have had the experience that if parents are actively denigrating of a partner and opposed to the partnership, one of the sad lessons that they learn, particularly with adolescents, is that one of the ways for the adolescent to prove that he or she is independent of you as a parent is to spit in your eye and marry up with, get pregnant with, whatever, with the partner that the parents don't like. So the advice usually in parenting is, even if you don't like the boyfriend or the girlfriend, don't actively criticize. Don't be opposed to it, because a teenager particularly is likely to say, oh, if my parents don't like him, it must be good. Or, if I partner up with him, I get this secondary gain. I can annoy my parents and push their buttons because they don't like my partner. And I can prove that I have my own will. I can make my own decisions, and they're not going to make them for me. So how do you do it? This is a practical advice. It doesn't come from Bronfenbrenner. In my case, what worked pretty well in one of my kids' relationships, a couple of them, one of them I just told my daughter I didn't like, and I told her fiancé, I don't like what I hear or what I don't hear, and we had a discussion, and they broke up. Nice guy, bad relationship. It wasn't doing what it needed to do. So sometimes you just have to say, I don't like it. I like you, I like you, but what you do together isn't going to work for me. I'm not going to be a supportive third party. But by that time, they were in their 20s, and they knew what they were doing. But the one that really worked much more subtly was that every time my daughter or son would get into a new relationship, the first thing I would do is, good, dinner, our house, pick a night, and get here, and we're going to have the best dinner. You get to choose the menu, and so we get the kid there. This started in middle school. It was really fun. It was really fun because what happened was that, and the strategy here we'll talk about later when we talk about what happens when you partner up. So I'm going to give you a little preview. What happens here is you bring the potential partner into your familiar environment. And one of the things that happens when you partner up is you enter each other's familiar environments. And part of the courting process is to find out whether you can be comfortable in your partner's familiar environment that is totally new to you. And so the deal is you come in and you have a great dinner, and your daughter or your son, depending, gets to see this potential or this new partner in your familiar setting, and gets to see how they deal with being the new kid, literally, at the table. And it was very interesting a couple of times to watch my daughter bring people home. They're happy to be there. You don't offer them alcohol because they're underage, but there they are, and you don't have to say anything when your kid is observing the lack of table manners and ability to use a knife and fork and chewing at the mouth open and all those other things that by the time they get to that point you've taught them not to do. And they see that this person clearly comes from a very different environment, and it raises doubt. You don't have to say a thing. You just trust your kids to see this person is not comfortable, and then you say, well, he was very interesting, and you go on about your business, and she dumps him. It works very well. And we'll talk more specifically about the courting process from a developmental perspective, because a major part of it is seeing your partner in his or her familiar environment and in your familiar environment, and seeing yourself in that person's familiar environment. Sharing those settings is an important piece of the courting process. And if you don't do it, people don't do it sometimes. They don't go into the other person's familiar setting. They get married, they have a couple of kids, and then they go visit the family. Oh my gosh, let me out of here. What did I get myself into? You really need to know the other person's world and know that you can be comfortable in it. Okay. So, we've got activities, we've got relationships. A roll is made out of flour. It has cinnamon and sugar and... No, this is a roll with one L and an E. Okay. Not a cinnamon roll, not a breakfast roll. Okay. This is a roll. A set of activities and relations expected of a person occupying a particular position in society and of others in relation to that person. This is the third element. We have activities, relations, and roles. And they're all confounded with each other, and they're all related to each other, but we can focus on them separately for the sake of analysis. And here we are. A role is a set of activities and a set of relations that you expect of a particular person. So we're combining these and saying, well, those expectations that we have in a particular position, expectations for activities and for the way you relate to other people and how other people relate to you, define the role. And I'm not going to elaborate terribly much on this notion, because I think I talked it to death in the book, and you can read that three or four times, and when you wake up in the morning, you'll understand it. After you've read it, you obviously will go to sleep. But to think about roles: father, mother, teacher, student, advisor, guidance counselor, principal, superintendent, minister, president, member of Congress. The world, our whole environment, is full of people who occupy particular roles. That's how we identify them. We have kinship roles, uncle, aunt. All those labels that apply to people and identify who they are imply or specify particular roles. And each one of those roles comes with a set of expectations for the way you behave and relate to other people. If you're a grandfather, you are supposed to think about your grandchildren, and you're supposed to be wise and kind and help them do things that their parents wouldn't approve of. Those are part of the activities and part of the relationship. You're supposed to love them even when their parents are not sure they do. And you're supposed to teach your children all the things teach your grandchildren the things their parents don't want you to. So that's what grandfathers are for. And it's an important part of the role. Some of you had grandfathers that you absolutely loved because they let you do all kinds of things that were dangerous and things that were hidden from their parents, and you had secrets, and they wrote you letters and slipped you $10 bills, and they may still do that, and $50 bills, and send you checks on your birthday, and think that you're the best thing since sliced bread and chocolate pudding. Right? That's a grandfather. I'm working on it. The president has a role. And our evaluation of a person as an occupant of a particular role is based on whether we think the person is carrying out the role appropriately. If we have a set of expectations for the role, for example, of president, and I may get off this before I get on it. If we have a set of expectations for a person who's in the role of doctor, I'm going to leave the president alone. He's got enough problems. Nobody approves of him. If you're in the role of doctor, there are certain things that you're supposed to do. And we will say that a doctor is good if she carries out those activities and relates to us in a way that we approve of for a person in that role. And we think badly of the doctor and evaluate her poorly if she doesn't do the things she's supposed to do. She doesn't listen to us. She doesn't pick up on our hints that we really have a bigger problem than we're letting on. She's supposed to read our minds. She's supposed to respond appropriately. She's supposed to do the right test. She's supposed to talk to us appropriately, have a good bedside manner. All of those things are part of the role of being a physician. And if people do it really well, we say they're great. And if people are lousy at it, we say they should have been plumbers. Or I don't want to pick on plumbers. Plumbers also have a role, a very important one in our society. So the notion of role is embedded throughout the society, and a role is defined by particular activities that you're supposed to carry out in that role. A role is also defined by the way you're supposed to relate to other people who interact with you in that role. So it's transactional. And the third component, at least the third, is if you are in that role, people are supposed to relate to you appropriately. So I'm not supposed to walk into the doctor's office and say, "Hiya, doc. Want to write me a prescription for, about 300, I don't know, what's the drug of choice now? I don't know, whatever it is that doctors get. And if you do that, I'll take you out to lunch. And you're kind of cute, so I don't think my wife would mind if we go out to lunch." You have those inappropriate transactions with people in their particular roles. So we are being inappropriate if we don't behave in the way that is prescribed for somebody interacting in that role. A very important component of roles is that they tend to be transactional. They are defined by the dyadic relationships between people who are in the role and people who are interacting with you in the role. You can't teach if you don't have students. You can't be an advisor if nobody comes to you for advice. You can't be a minister if you don't have anybody to preach to. You can't be a counselor if you don't have any counselees. They're interlocking transactional roles. And the role definition applies not only what you do, but to the nature of the transaction in the relationship. Okay? Let's look at what Bronfenbrenner suggests about roles. How many roles do you occupy? Many of us occupy many roles. Particularly if you add the kinship roles, you start talking about who you are. You're a daughter, you're a girlfriend, you're a granddaughter, you're a sister, you're a niece, you can start adding those kinship roles, but you're also a student, a sales associate, a friend, a big buddy, a member of the dance team, a swimmer, a future teacher. You've got all of those roles that you occupy at the same time. When you're an infant, you tend not to have many roles. You're an infant. Very simple. What happens over development is that we learn new roles. We learn to play them, to occupy them, how to do them, and we learn how to relate to them. So we learn how to have the transactional relationship with somebody in the role. We learn how to be a child. I've been interested for many years with the fact that we teach people the activities and the role of parenting. And it occurred to me one time in a random moment, when do we teach children what their role is? How do you teach a child childing? Do we have child education classes? How to be a child? And the fantasy that I had actually came true when a person, I think he was at Wisconsin, created a workshop for teenagers on how to be a teenager. It was fascinating. He took everything he knew about the parent-teenager relationship and started offering to teach teenagers, and he did it, to teach teenagers how to relate to their parents, to keep their parents secure in their role, but let you keep on developing. Very interesting concept. Teening. He was teaching the role of being a teen. But he was teaching the kids how to survive their parents' idiocy. Because all parents become idiots when you're a teenager, right? Well, many of them do. So we need to teach kids how to get along with their parents and not lose their dignity, their identity, their integrity. And I've often thought he was brilliant, particularly because I had the idea first. I just didn't do anything with it. When we put a person in a role, if I say you're the teacher today, we tend to bring out in that person their understanding of how you play that role. And it's a funny kind of thing to do. So you assign your kindergartner the role of teacher for the day, or maybe for 10 minutes, that's probably all you can tolerate. But give a kindergartner the role of teacher, and you tell the whole class, okay, Eric is going to be the teacher for the next 15 minutes or whatever. And you get to see how Eric views the role of teacher, and then you get to see whether everybody else is able to relate to him in the appropriate way. Can they let him take that role? It's a fun thing to do. And the literature includes a number of studies of situations where people have been put in particular roles, or other people have been told that they have it, and you can see the behavior change to come into line with the expectations that people have for the particular role. It's very subtle. You don't have to instruct people. But if I tell you somebody is a policeman and you're at a party and he's in civvies and I tell you he's a policeman, your behavior will change. I tell you he's off duty. I tell you he's out of his jurisdiction. Your behavior will still change because he occupies this very powerful role. And you tend not to do things in the presence of people you know are policemen that you might otherwise do if there weren't any policemen in the room. And transactionally, if I out him, the policeman at the party, his behavior changes. He can have a great time and be out of the policeman role, but once I identify him as a policeman, his behavior changes to become more policemanish, policemanlike. And so you have the transaction going on that everybody gets uncomfortable. And you expect that, and you're taught to deal with that if you go to the police academy. Because you deserve to have a life, but you just have to find where your parties are all with other police people, or you go places where nobody knows you're a policeman, and you don't pack a weapon. It happens for many of us. As a psychologist, one of the things I noticed early on in my career was when I went to parties, people would say, "What do you do?" "I'm a psychologist." They take two steps back, and then they stop talking about themselves. They find other things to talk about. But they assume that you're psychologizing them. I was on a date once with a beautiful woman, young woman, before I was married. And I was having what I thought was just a fine conversation, learning about her. And it's a nice conversation. I was learning all about her, and it's fun. And she stopped short at one point and said, "Are you psychoanalyzing me?" Killed the conversation, killed the date, killed the relationship. Oh well. If the role is well established, such as psychologist or policeman or president of the United States, the very powerful role, very clear expectations of it, and the more powerful it is, the clearer the expectations is, the more power it has to evoke the appropriate behavior. One of the issues that we have is often we get put into positions where we don't really know what the role is. It's called role ambiguity. And some of you have been in those situations. You've gotten a new job, or you've taken an internship, or you're volunteering someplace, and you're uncomfortable because you don't know what your role is. You don't know what the activities are. You don't know whether you can do them. You don't know what the expectations are. And we're uncomfortable in a new setting, in a new situation, until we learn the role. And sometimes we get into situations where you have to create the role. And that's always interesting. When you've got carte blanche, do it the way you think it should be done. We don't have a job description for you. We don't know what your job is. We just know we hired somebody to sort of take care of whatever this part of it is. And here's your desk, but we don't know how you relate to everybody else. I had a student in graduate course last semester who had been in a particular career for several years, a couple of them, and she'd moved along, and an organization decided they wanted somebody to do something to connect their organization to all the other organizations that were like them in the state and to advocate for the people that these organizations were advocating for. And they'd never had a paid staff person to do this, and so they hired her, saying, we don't know what the job is, but this is what we like the outcome to be, and we don't know how you should do it, we don't know how you relate to everybody else. She's having a ball. She says, first time she's ever been offered a paycheck to do what she thought she needed to do and wanted to do, and the board just keeps, she's under the direction of a board of directors who raised the money, and they don't have a clue what she's supposed to do. And so they finally, after she'd been in the job for about 6 months, she told them, you need to evaluate me. I think she wanted a raise, but you need to evaluate me. And they said, well, you'll have to make up your own evaluation instrument to tell us how to evaluate you, and we'll do it. Talk about having the power. She's got it. The ambiguity for many of us keeps us from being comfortable. In her case, we'll look at a hypothesis later on, 36 or 37 in the book, that applies to her going into a new setting, being ready for it, and able to take the reins and do what you think needs to be done. But for most of us, we move into a new place with that kind of ambiguity, we tremble a little bit, and we're anxious. Power corrupts. And Bronfenbrenner is reflecting that in this hypothesis when he suggests that roles that have power assigned to them, where you can exercise power, are important because of that power, and the more power you have in that role, the more likely you are to exercise it, and the more likely other people are to relate to you in a way that recognizes that power. My favorite illustration of that is when the blue light comes on behind you and you're on the interstate. And you pull over and the trooper pulls in behind you and gets out of the car and has already checked your license plate, and you're wondering, what did I do? I was probably speeding. And we all get anxious, and we roll down the window. We're very careful. Don't make sudden moves. Don't reach for your license, which is probably in the, or your registration, which is in the glove compartment, until the trooper can see that, you know, we know all those things. I don't want to get shot. They have a lot of power. And the last time that happened to me, I rolled down the window, and I'm sitting there kind of trembling, and he says, did you know your license plate light was out? No. I just thought you'd want to know. You probably should get it fixed. Thank you. Okay. Now I can breathe again. I can stop sweating in a few minutes and we'll be okay. How well you can play a particular role depends in part on how well other people are playing their role transactionally with you. So the ability to fill a role depends in part on how you understand that role and your ability to actually engage in the activities But if other people don't do what they're supposed to do, it's very difficult for you to carry out the role effectively. So, if you walk into a high school and you're going to be the teacher, and for some reason, because you're new and you don't know the territory, you have been assigned a class of misfits who should have been thrown out of school before, and they sense that you may not quite know how to play your role, you may have a miserable time trying to be a teacher because they won't let you, because they are doing everything they can to sabotage your activities in that role. Some of you have had and will have the experience of going into a high school where you are in a class or you get assigned a class of people who are eager to have you be a good teacher, and they will do everything they can to help you learn the ropes, teach you about how the school operates and what they like, and they'll be very cooperative and they'll say, yeah, okay, we like you because you're doing something different and we'll try it and we'll let you know if we don't. And they're supporting you and they're saying you're a great teacher. Okay. It's much easier for you to become a teacher in that situation where everybody else is relating to you appropriately than it is if they are trying to sabotage what you're doing. Those are evident. And one of the important pieces for Bronfenbrenner is that as we try to fill a role, we try to live up to the expectations in it. And if you, he took this from some interesting literature about setting up situations where kids will be competitive and comparing them to a camp situation where all the games and the activities were cooperative. And if you compare what often is a typical competitive, you know, tent against tent or group against group, lots of competition, lots of games with winners and losers, you compare that to a camp that's focused on cooperation and collaborative activities, you find that the kids tend to behave as the games and the counselors expect them to in those situations. And you can extend that to any kind of set of expectations. If you expect a child to behave well and make that expectation clear and support the child in behaving well, you're likely to get a kid who behaves well. If you're expecting the kid to be a problem when you take him or her out, and you start warning the kid about not being a problem, or I'm going to get you, you're probably creating a problem. The kid is going to live up to the specific expectations that you seem to be expressing. Oh, so my parent is really afraid I'll be a problem. My parent thinks I'll be a problem. I guess I'll be a problem and test this. Depending on what kind of kid you are. So think about any particular role and what the expectations are of it, and the important difference is whether people know how they are supposed to act in the role. If you're a father, you're supposed to be loving and nurturing and affectionate and warm and cuddly and really responsive and listen to your kids, right? That's the definition of father. Or, and if that's the expectation you have, if that's the way the role is supposed to be played, you're likely to do that. But there are other versions of that role out there in the public eye, and one of them is that fathers are responsible for making sure that their kids don't get out of line, for keeping their kids in control, for telling their kids what to do, for keeping them from thinking on their own, and your evaluation as a father will be based on how tough you are. If that's what you're getting, then that's what you're likely to do. In society, if we want to change a particular problem, we often have to redefine the role and make that public and encourage. It's a slow change. For example, one of the things that I do is train instructors for a course that parents have to take. If they're parents and they have kids under 18 and they get divorced in Vermont, they have to take a 4-hour workshop. and I train the instructors for that workshop. And when I started doing this and working with divorcing parents 15 or 20 years ago, it very quickly became apparent to those of us who were working in the project that many people have a view, and it is supported by their relatives and their friends, that people who get divorced are supposed to hate each other, and they're supposed to hurt each other, and they're supposed to use the kids to make sure the other parent has a miserable life. And they do that. And people are very upset and critical if parents get along with each other and do things together. And if you're in a new relationship, you often find that that person doesn't want you to be nice to your ex or to spend time with your kids. Those are definitions of the role that are destructive to children's development because they're destructive to the relationship between the parent and child. Kids, as many of you have experienced, thrive much better if their parents get along happily with each other, which you can do when you get divorced because you end a problem. You end a problem by getting divorced. The last resort, you can't solve it any other way. You figure if you live separately. And the reality is that many people who get divorced immediately become much happier and more relaxed and able to engage in appropriate relationships because they're not being affected by that nasty dyad that was affecting everybody in the household. But what we have had to do in our workshops is to promote a different view of the divorced parent role and to directly counteract the one that's out there. And we regularly, in the workshop that we do, have people tell us, well, you know, I'm trying to cooperate, but her mother is telling her, you know, that she has to keep the kids from seeing me. And you know, so we need to help that parent deal with his ex's mother because she's a problem, because her view of the role is inappropriate. So we actually put people through a bit of script of how to tell your friends and your extended family what you define the role as, and that they can butt out. So we tell them, you tell all the grandparents they are not permitted to speak ill of either parent, period, to the kids. They may not. Their role is to support both of you in parenting. Your role is to get along with your ex, at least be civil and never embarrass your child. Your role is to support your ex's parenting. Even if you hate her, doesn't matter. Even if you hate her, your role as a parent is to support her parenting of your children and to constantly reinforce that relationship. And people look at us and but when you look at the kids who are doing well, that's what their parents do. And it came home for me when I got divorced because my wife and I had a very civil divorce and we never badmouthed each other in front of the kids and we, you know, we go to all the weddings and things. We party together. We do all of those things together. And the extension of that that's really nice is that my wife and her ex, my current wife and her ex, also do the same thing. So we can have functions with the kids where everybody is there. His new girlfriend and our new marriage, and we can all be there together and we all get along and we like each other because we don't have to live with each other. And we're all happier in our new lives than we were in our old lives. And the kids really appreciate that. But the reality is that when parents get along, the kids get along. But where I was going with that story is my first wife had to tell people when they assumed that I was a nasty guy because we had divorced, there must be something wrong with me, right? Her friends immediately started badmouth me to her, and her mother did, and she had to tell them, stop. Oh, that's not it. That's not what it's about. And I don't need to hear it. And I don't need to defend him. Please, just assume he's always been a good guy. We just don't get along. So. But that role definition is out there and people expect to have to live it unless we change the role definition. And that's part of social change, to change the role definition so people can play it differently. We'll look at other examples of that. And why are roles important? Because your development is in part a function of the different kinds of roles that you learn to occupy and to interact with. So when you're a child, and when you're a teenager, and still when you're an adult, the variety and complexity of the roles that you have learned to play, to occupy, is one way of looking at your development. Because if you understand those roles and have had the chance to play them, to participate in them, you have a better understanding of the world that you live in. Remember Bronfenbrenner's definition of human development? The process of acquiring a valid and differentiated view of the world you live in. Roles are a significant part of the world you live in. So the more of them you actually understand by having worked, having played them, and having related to them on the other side of that, the better you understand the world you live in. So, do we give kids lots of roles to play? Do we encourage that? Do we give them lots of opportunities to be in different kinds of positions in school, in childhood, in the community? To the extent that we do that and help them learn to play those roles, we are encouraging their development. Okay, now we have roles, relationships, and activities. Questions about roles? I'm supposed to ask you occasionally if you're awake. I mean, if you have any questions. And I forget that I've been over this stuff so often that sometimes I forget that it may not be clear. So I should stop and ask. If it's not, please, your role is to ask me a question if you don't understand something or if you have an example or a question about it. You okay for now? Okay. Yes. Okay. That's a nice example. What happens when you're a doctor and your husband comes in as a patient? Say you're in the emergency room and this unconscious, mangled person comes in still alive and it turns out to be your spouse. Okay. That's a real situation that has happened. The ethics of doctoring and psychologizing and lawyering and dentist, I think dentists have, anyway, a whole bunch of things in healthcare and the legal profession and mental health is it is not appropriate to treat a family member or close friend. So the ethics are you can't do it. On the other hand, if you're the only competent person in the emergency room and your mangled spouse or kid comes in, you suck it up and do what you have to do. And that is a terrible situation to be put in. But it does happen in certain situations. But normally, it's a role conflict. And that's the general principle that I talk about in the book, and it's important about roles, is that because we often occupy several roles, they may not fit well together, and we are often faced with role conflict. We are in two roles at the same time, and they are incompatible with each other. And you can probably think of lots of examples of that. All of the proscriptions, you know, you may not date a patient. You may not develop a romantic relationship with a client if you're a mental health professional. And there are guidelines, ethics in psychology about how long you have to wait before you can be social with a former client. And there's debate about those sorts of things. But you can't date them while you're treating them. Those are conflicting roles, and they just don't work together. It's unethical to do that. so you may not do it. You must, if the transference is such, as we call it, that you, the romantic intent or desire is interfering with the professional role of helper, you have to pass the client off to somebody else. You're obligated to recognize when you're not being effective because you're not keeping to your role. So there are lots of situations like that. And as we look at settings and we look at people's ecosystems, we'll ask, are the roles that they're in congruent with each other? Is it congruent to be a varsity athlete at a Division I school and a student? I heard a wonderful commentary on NPR last weekend. I've forgotten who it was. The guy was simply saying, let's stop kidding ourselves that Division I football teams are occupied by student athletes. And let's just pay them. It's entertainment. And their coaches get paid 5 times more than the college president. And that's okay, because it's entertainment and it's big bucks. But we put the students in this terrible, the players in this terrible incongruent situation when we expect them to maintain a whatever to graduate. And if you look at the Division I football playing schools, the number of their athletes, their football players who actually graduate is, let's say, low. And the NCAA looks at that. Some of you are familiar with it. I remember University of Washington, which has 700 scholarship athletes in different sports. They looked at the top 3 sports, which I think are basketball, hockey, and football. Maybe baseball, maybe not hockey. I'm not sure. Anyway, they looked at the graduation rate in 6 years to get through varsity athletes. They put them on probation, and they hired a friend of mine to set up a program to help the varsity athletes figure out how to be in school, because nobody taught them what the role was. Because we are just barely Division I and newly Division I in some sports. And many of us on faculty are very interested to see whether that will continue. Yeah, that's the figure that we're looking at, the GPA and the graduation rate for student athletes. Because as some of you know, at UVM, the expectations for athletes in some sports have been ratcheted up. And I've had advisees in a couple of those sports who have experienced the change. You know, there's more emphasis on women winning, more emphasis on practicing, and a lot of support for the academic piece. But sometimes it's a little more than they bargained for. But UVM has had a long history of not recruiting people who can't make it, and that's important. But if you go to a place like the University of Washington, I'm picking on them only because I know them, or some of the other like Big Ten schools. I was a graduate student at Minnesota, and you look at the role of student athletes there, and it had nothing to do with being a student. And they were recruiting people based on their athletic skills, period, and then creating courses for them that they could pass with reasonable grades, but they had no relationship to a college curriculum. That's a harsh statement for me to say, but that was the reality. And they had their own fraternity, and they had their own support groups, and they had their own people to take exams for them. And those are incompatible roles. We don't do that at UVM. Okay, thank you for that question, because it raises the question of whether the roles are compatible and congruent and how they fit together, and whether or not the environment supports you carrying out your role or your multiple roles. So when we look at employers, for example, do they support employees as parents? First day of school, you go to school with your kids, right? Kid gets sick, as a parent, you don't go to work. You stay with your kid. Kid has a school play, you get off early, right? Not in some businesses, not in some employment situations. and they differ in how supportive they are of the parent role. And that's a big problem for many parents, that you either support your kids or you keep your job, and those roles aren't compatible. They're not supported. Let me tell you where we're going briefly and where you should be. Think about the places where you live your life, and we'll talk about settings on Monday, because then after we think about the places, then we're going to look at the system of roles, relationships, and activities that exist in each of the settings where you are. So we're moving toward the systems piece. How do these things all fit together? But they fit together in settings. Have a great Groundhog Day. Eat lots of groundhog. And I'll see you Monday. Don't forget rabbit.